This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of March 20th. Trump offers shifting goals for the war. A defiant Iran intensified its attacks on Arab states and U.S. assets across the Middle East as President Trump seesawed on America's war aims and when the joint U.S.-Israeli offensive on Iran might end. Thousands of Iranian missiles and drones have rained down on Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other Arab nations, smashing into oil refineries, airports, residential buildings, and hotels, and killing at least 16 people. At least 11 U.S. military bases have been hit, damaging communications infrastructure and air defense systems and partially collapsing some buildings, according to satellite imagery reviewed by the New York Times. The Pentagon said at least 140 U.S. troops have been wounded, 8 seriously, and 7 have been killed. In Israel, Iranian strikes have killed at least 13 people. As the damage mounted, Trump judged the operation very complete, pretty much. Within hours, he backtracked, saying the U.S. was bent on ultimate victory, while still asserting it would end very soon. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth insisted the assault was at just the beginning. Asked which of those things was true, Trump said, "I think you could say both." Inside Iran, Mojtaba Khamenei, the 56-year-old son of assassinated Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, was selected to replace his father as the nation's supreme leader. Trump, who insisted he must approve any new leader, said the selection of Khamenei, a hardline cleric with deep ties to the elite Revolutionary Guard, was unacceptable, judging it would lead to more of the same problems. The U.S. and Israel continued to pound targets across Iran. More than 1,300 Iranians have died in the strikes, most of them civilians, according to the Iranian Red Crescent Society. "They are striking everywhere, homes, schools, mosques, hospitals," said one Tehran resident. In Washington, Democrats berated Trump's failure to articulate a clear plan. After a closed-door briefing, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut called the administration incoherent. He said it had backed off the previously stated goals of regime change and destroying Iran's nuclear weapons program, and that it had no plan for reopening the Strait of Hormuz, where shipping has come to a standstill. Meanwhile, defiant Iranian leaders ruled out a ceasefire or mediation. "Iran will determine when the war ends," said Iranian Revolutionary Guard spokesman Ali Mohammed Naini. There is a growing realization inside the administration that Trump and his team misjudged how the Iranian regime would respond to a conflict it views as an existential threat, said Mark Mazzetti in the New York Times. They thought the war would follow the same pattern as last year's U.S.-Israeli strikes, when Iran's retaliation was fairly muted. That Tehran responded with far more aggression has forced administration officials to adjust plans on the fly. Some are growing pessimistic about the lack of an exit strategy, but they are careful not to express that directly to Trump, who's called the operation a complete success. "It's not too late for Trump to build a case for the war," said Therese Shaheen in National Review. The Iranian regime has been an active, aggressive foe of the U.S. for 47 years and was building capacity to cause catastrophic damage with its nuclear program. "The public's not buying it," said Greg Sargent in the New Republic. A poll aggregator found only 38% of Americans approve of the offensive, the lowest initial support for an American war perhaps ever. Among Iranians, faith in the U.S. project is also in short supply, said Najmeh Bozarmer in the Financial Times. At the war's outset, opponents of the brutal regime hoped better days were at hand, but the terrifying air campaign has shattered that belief. Choking on toxic black smog from burning oil depots, many Tehran residents are shocked by the destruction of schools, thousands of homes, and historic landmarks, and dismayed by the resilience of the Islamic regime. There is no sign of the anti-regime unrest that erupted in January. Instead, one sociologist in Tehran, a critic of the regime, sees a rising sense of nationalism. Mojtaba Khamenei's ascent is a grim sign, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Instead of a shift toward a less confrontational government, his selection represents regime consolidation, and Trump's tone-deaf demand for veto power over Iran's supreme leader is yet another sign he profoundly misunderstands his opponents. He thought they'd crumble at his shock and awe campaign, but Iran has been preparing for this fight since 1988, and they are ready for a long war. Now Trump must decide if he is too. Trump should declare victory and walk away, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. Regime change would be the ideal outcome, but that would require ground troops and take years and many American lives. As it stands, U.S. and Israeli strikes have severely damaged Iran's military capability, knocking out missile launchers, air defenses, and more than 60 naval craft. Quitting now, as some advisors are reportedly urging, would serve Trump best politically while saving the U.S. from a potential quagmire. Trump is confounded by the war he started, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark. Pumped with hubris after last year's Iran strikes and the capture of Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro, he and his team thought the U.S. could simply impose its will on smaller countries with little cost. Now they're waking up to the fact that they have plunged into a morass without the support of the American people. The president and his advisors didn't anticipate an actual war, but now they've got one, and they don't have the faintest idea how to end it. As Iran batters region, throttling oil market. The International Energy Agency announced the largest release of its oil reserves in history in an attempt to rein in skyrocketing oil prices after Iran choked off access to the Strait of Hormuz and bombarded oil facilities in Arab states. The IEA, whose members include the U.S. and much of the West, approved a release of 400 million barrels of oil, and President Trump said he would tap the U.S. strategic reserve. The announcements came after Iran mined the Strait, a conduit for 20% of the world's oil, and launched hundreds of missiles and drones against oil drilling and refining sites in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Iraq, causing casualties, fires, and infrastructure damage. Iran also hurled drones at commercial ships in the region, hitting three and setting one aflame. As a bottleneck of hundreds of tankers built up, Trump suggested the Navy could escort ships through the strait, although the Pentagon said it had no orders to do so. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said reopening the passage was critical. If they can't keep it open, he said, this war will in fact be an American defeat before very long because the entire world will react to the price of oil. After Trump said that more expensive energy was a small price to pay for defeating Iran, oil briefly hit $120 a barrel, then dropped somewhat. Gasoline prices shot up 20% to average over $3.50 a gallon, and diesel prices rose by over 25%. Running out of storage and unable to intercept all of Iran's strikes, Iraq, Kuwait, and other Gulf nations slashed their oil production. We are in a potentially game-changing and unprecedented energy crisis, said former IEA official Neil Atkinson. The oil crisis has become impossible to either ignore or deny, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. The costs of fuel, gasoline, and domestic shipping are rising even as the economy slows. That combination could cause stagflation, last seen in the 1970s. And while every previous oil shock in American history was the result of external events such as foreign wars, disasters, or terrorist attacks, this one was caused by the wishes of the U.S. president. Trump should have known that Iran would close the strait, said Franklin Foer in The Atlantic. Almost no other foreign policy question has been studied harder over the past 20 years or so than the likely effect of U.S. military strikes on Iran. No other president chose a full-scale attack because analysts were convinced that to do so would cause skyrocketing oil prices and rampant violence across the Middle East. The president ignored the obvious because he thought he was invincible, and now the obvious is taking its revenge. The U.S. is more exposed to oil price shocks than any other major power, including China, said Rosemary Kalanick in the New York Times. We have a high oil intensity, meaning it takes the U.S. much more oil than most other countries to produce each dollar of GDP. Releasing oil from reserves can help only temporarily. No wonder the GOP is panicking, said Meredith Lee Hill in Politico. Analysts say the impact of the crisis could erase the tax benefits from the Big Beautiful Bill for at least the bottom 30% of Americans. Voters who are suffering may punish Republicans in the midterms. The high prices are good for at least one country, Russia, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Oil sales make up a huge chunk of Russia's revenue, and money is pouring in. Compounding that windfall, the U.S. actually granted a sanctions waiver to India, which is running short of oil and gas thanks to the Strait's closure, so it can buy Russian oil. China's doing pretty well, too. It's sitting on a stockpile of up to 1.4 billion barrels of crude while still managing to get oil shipped from Iran. And it's watching the U.S. use up weapons on Iran, weapons that won't be available to protect Taiwan should Beijing attack. How this war ends may be less a question of drones, ships, and artillery than supply chains, inflation, and debt markets, said Rana Forohar in the Financial Times. Iranian leaders are betting that the rise in oil prices will threaten such an economic cataclysm that Trump has to call off the war. If the long-term impact of this war is to trigger a big sell-off in U.S. treasuries, the U.S. and global economy will suffer mightily. Hegseth waging a macho war in Iran. Does Pete Hegseth think he's in an action movie? Asked Casey Ryan Kelly in Salon. In his Pentagon news briefings on the war with Iran, the defense secretary has projected none of the solemnity you'd expect from a government official discussing the taking of human life. Instead, Hegseth seems giddy about the horrors of war, rhapsodizing about U.S. bombers and drones raining death and destruction from the sky all day long. He's dismissed concerns about the rules of engagement, explaining it is not a fair fight. We are punching them while they're down. And he's shrugged at news reports on America's war dead, saying, tragic things happen. The press only wants to make the president look bad. This is what President Trump thinks a real warrior looks and sounds like, said David Smith in The Guardian. A Christian nationalist with tattoos of the Crusades-era Jerusalem cross and slogan Deus Vult, God wills it, Hegseth won Trump's attention as a Fox News host advocating for U.S. troops accused of war crimes. He's the perfect figurehead for a White House that revels in carnage and which posted a video online that mixed clips from video games and war movies with real kill shot footage of strikes in Iran. This bloodlust may play well in the manosphere, but it doesn't inspire confidence in the judgment of those leading this murky new Middle East conflict. The bellicose messaging of this administration is accompanied by open hostility to battlefield restraint, said Missy Ryan in The Atlantic. We still don't know why a U.S. Tomahawk cruise missile struck an Iranian elementary school on the war's first day, killing at least 175 people, most of them children. But we do know Trump and Hegseth have spent the past year dismantling the supposedly woke systems designed to prevent such tragedies, firing many military lawyers or JAGs, and closing a policy shop focused on reducing civilian casualties. Hegseth says he won't comment on the school strike pending an internal investigation, but he was less reticent in savoring the quiet death of 87 Iranian sailors killed when a U.S. submarine torpedoed a possibly unarmed Iranian frigate off Sri Lanka. Distastefulness aside, said Charlotte Howard in The Economist, the deeper problem with Hegseth's machismo style is that it's now also the substance of U.S. military policy. Machismo is part of the story, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, but the fetishization of violence for its own sake is also helping fill a strategic vacuum. Previous U.S. presidents went to war with a clear goal in mind, however unrealistic, whereas Trump is still deciding if the Iran operation is an air campaign to degrade Iran's nuclear and missile programs, a full-scale regime change war, or something else entirely. The lack of a goal and a plan for achieving it leaves the White House with nothing to celebrate except the rapid destruction of buildings and machines and the killing of some enemy leaders, all while praying that the public is enjoying the fireworks as much as Hegseth. The tragedy is that Trump had very good reasons for going to war with Iran, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. The vicious Islamist regime in Tehran has waged war on the U.S. and the Iranian people for almost half a century. Given an opportunity to inflict massive damage on that enemy, the president boldly seized it. But rather than make that persuasive case to the public, Trump and Hegseth have leaned on intemperate, incontinent, infantilizing verbiage that only weakens support for this just cause at home and overseas and corrupts our national culture. Maricopa County, Arizona, election subpoena. A federal grand jury in Arizona subpoenaed Maricopa County voting records from the 2020 presidential election, opening a new front in President Trump's expanding and baseless hunt for evidence of fraud. The subpoena was sought by the FBI and sent to the Republican-led Arizona State Senate, which already commissioned a review of nearly 2.1 million ballots in the county and found no evidence of fraud in an election won by Joe Biden. In fact, it found 99 additional votes for Biden and 261 fewer votes for Trump. State Senate President Warren Peterson said he complied with the order, writing on X that the FBI has the records. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, said federal law enforcement was being weaponized in service of crackpots and lies. The move comes 6 weeks after federal officials raided an election office in Fulton County, Georgia, as part of an investigation into defects in the vote count. El Paso, Texas, worse than prison. The Department of Homeland Security said it will close a makeshift immigrant detention center that has been the site of multiple detainee deaths and disease outbreaks, including a measles outbreak last week. Camp East Montana opened at Fort Bliss outside El Paso just 7 months ago and housed nearly 3,000 immigrants at one time. The Associated Press reported that 911 received nearly a call a day from the staff at the center, where detainees reported assault, squalid conditions, and lack of nutrition. One call concerned a pregnant woman complaining of intense pain, while at least six calls reported detainees attempting to harm themselves. Owen Ramsingh, who spent weeks there before getting deported to the Netherlands, said he overheard guards betting on which detainee would commit suicide. Camp East Montana was 1,000% worse than a prison, he said. ICE's own inspectors found dozens of violations of federal standards at the camp, but the department has not released the report. New York City, new Epstein documents. After pressure from Democrats, the Justice Department published several documents related to the Jeffrey Epstein investigation that were missing from last month's record dump, including three FBI interviews with a woman who claims that President Trump sexually abused her as a minor. In the interviews, which took place in 2019, the woman alleges that Epstein introduced her to Trump in New York or New Jersey when she was between the ages of 13 and 15. The woman said she bit Trump's penis after he forced her head to his crotch. Trump then punched her in the face, she said. "Get this little bitch the hell out of here," she recalls him saying. Trump has denied any wrongdoing, and the White House called the allegations completely baseless accusations backed by zero credible evidence from a sadly disturbed woman. The agency said the missing files were not deliberately withheld, but had simply been incorrectly coded. New York City terrorist attack. Federal prosecutors charged two teens with an ISIS-inspired attack near the official residence of New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani after they lobbed makeshift explosives at protesters. Amir Balat, 18, and Ibrahim Kayumi, 19, both of Pennsylvania, told investigators they were motivated by the Islamic State and were hoping their attack would be even bigger than the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013 that only killed three. They allegedly threw the bombs, laced with powerful explosives and metal, at an anti-Islam rally outside the Muslim mayor's mansion organized by people associated with the far-right provocateur Jake Lang. The bombs failed to detonate and no one was injured. After the men were arrested, officials discovered a third device inside the suspect's car. The FBI also searched a storage unit in Pennsylvania. Mayor Mamdani was criticized for his response to the attack, in which he condemned both the terrorists and the protesters. Washington, D.C. security breach. The Social Security Administration is investigating a whistleblower complaint alleging that a former staffer for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, stole U.S. citizens' information and planned to share the files with his private employer, The Washington Post reported. According to the complaint filed in January, a former DOGE software engineer bragged to several co-workers that he possessed two databases named Numident and Master Death File that held records for more than 500 million living and dead Americans, including Social Security numbers and other identifiers. He allegedly told the whistleblower that he needed help transferring the data from a thumb drive to his personal computer before uploading it to a new company's systems. He allegedly told another colleague he expected a presidential pardon if caught. The complaint raises more concerns about DOGE members' compliance with the Privacy Act, which restricts how federal employees access and share data. Kyiv, drone advice. Ukraine has sent interceptor drones and a team of experts to help protect U.S. bases in Jordan against Iranian attack, President Volodymyr Zelensky told the New York Times. The U.S. requested the help shortly after the conflict began, and the Ukrainian team left the next day. Ukraine is also fielding requests from the leaders of Saudi Arabia and other Arab states. It is very important to coordinate for security, both in Europe and in the Middle East, Zelensky said. Since Russia invaded it in 2022, Ukraine has developed groundbreaking drone capabilities as well as expertise in fending off the tens of thousands of Shahed drones Iran has supplied to Russia. 7 months ago, Ukraine tried to sell its battle-tested anti-drone technology to the U.S., Axios reported, but the Trump administration declined. A U.S. official said that was a tactical error. Tehran, help from Russia. In its battle against the U.S. and Israel, Iran is getting help from Russia, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi confirmed, telling NBC's Meet the Press that the military partnership between Iran and Russia is strong. Western intelligence sources said Russia has shared the advanced drone warfare tactics it has developed over 4 years of waging war on Ukraine. It has also provided Iran with satellite imagery showing the locations of U.S. warships, aircraft, and military personnel, as well as the locations of military assets of America's Arab allies. Steve Witkoff, President Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, disputed the reports, saying that Russian President Vladimir Putin had personally denied those allegations in a phone call with Trump. "We can take them at their word," Witkoff said. People, Liu's triumphant return. Alyssa Liu does everything on her own terms, said Alyssa Hardy in Teen Vogue. The 20-year-old figure skater clinched gold for Team USA at the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics last month with a free skate to Donna Summer's MacArthur Park suite. It was a dazzlingly confident performance from an athlete who had quit the sport only 4 years earlier. A skating prodigy, Liu became the youngest ever U.S. national champion at 13, competed in the 2022 Beijing Olympics at 16, and won bronze in the World Championships the next month. Feeling burned out, she retired, a decision shaped by the pandemic when she experienced her first true day off. "That was something completely foreign to me," she says. Liu used her retirement to eat whatever she wanted, play video games, and hike the Himalayas. Eventually, she realized she missed skating. "I love doing stuff that I really don't want to do, really hard things." So, in 2024, she returned to the rink, but set her own rules. "I pick hanging out with my friends over a training session, and if that makes me a worse skater, so be it. I don't care. I will jeopardize whatever." She believes she inherited her sense of resolve from her father, who fled China after taking part in the country's 1989 pro-democracy protests. "My father has a backbone," Liu says, "so I have it too." Best columns of the U.S. Missing in action, J.D. Vance. A year into Donald Trump's second term, we are witnessing the humiliation of J.D. Vance, said Idris Kalun in The Atlantic. The former Ohio senator barreled into the White House full of ideas, but his opinions seemed to matter less and less. He embraced the America First foreign policy of no foreign wars and specifically insisted our interest is not in going to war with Iran. His boss has made that position look farcical, and Vance was notably not with Trump and other advisors at Mar-a-Lago as the attack began. As a working-class populist, Vance preached Teddy Roosevelt-style regulation of big business and support of unionization, but little of his influence is discernible in the administration's actions, while Trump relies heavily on, and frequently praises, Vance's likely 2028 rival, hawkish Secretary of State Marco Rubio. To some degree, Vance is suffering the typical fate of the vice president, who is forever on display but seldom listened to. But it's a major come down from the role he once seemed likely to fill as the bridge to Trumpism after Trump. If he runs as Trump's heir in 2028, he may need to defend policies that the 2024 version of Vance would oppose. Lebanon, at war again, thanks to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is dragging all of Lebanon along on its wretched suicide mission, said Issa Goraib in L'Orient Le Jour. We had hoped that after a series of disastrous adventures against Israel, the militant group would lie low and spare our country further misfortune. But once the U.S. and Israel began their titanic assault on its patron Iran and killed Iranian leader Ali Khamenei, Hezbollah launched a futile rocket attack on Israeli missile defenses to avenge the assassination. Predictably, Israel responded with terrible, disproportionate fury. Its troops stormed across the border, ordering civilians to clear out of dozens of towns. Hundreds of thousands of displaced people fled, clogging streets. Israeli drones buzzed overhead, and missiles pummeled apartment buildings in Beirut's southern suburbs, killing dozens. And Hezbollah kept firing back. While it was supposed to have disarmed under a November 2024 ceasefire with Israel, it used that respite to rebuild its forces. Now, Hezbollah leader Naim Qassem vows to fight to the death, and the Lebanese he claims to be defending are paying the price. The Iran war is just an excuse. Hezbollah was itching to confront Israel and impose a new military balance, said Maher el-Khatib in Al-Asnashra. Israel has been violating the 2024 ceasefire almost daily with military strikes in southern Lebanon. Qassem said Hezbollah's aim is to stop the aggression, not simply to stand up for Iran. But whatever the goal, the group has now torn up the ceasefire altogether. The recklessness could be Hezbollah's undoing, said David Daoud and Ahmed Sharawi in Ya'libnan. The Lebanese government, which had long balked at forcibly disarming the Shiite militia, effectively outlawed Hezbollah's military wing, making a civil war more likely. Hezbollah used to outgun the Lebanese armed forces, which are a melting pot of Shiite and Sunni Muslims, Christians, and Druze. Yet it is now politically and socially isolated, with its key ally in parliament recommending restraint and some 70% of Lebanese surveyed saying they opposed Hezbollah and wanted it disarmed. With what remains of Hezbollah's military strength tied up in another intense war with Israel, the state finally has a rare opportunity to take its guns by force. This is a tipping point, said Le Monde of France in an editorial. Civilians are fleeing, and it's Hezbollah that bears primary responsibility for their exodus. The group was created by Iran in 1982 to fill the power vacuum left in Lebanon after Israel expelled the Palestinian Liberation Organization from its Lebanese base. Hezbollah has always placed its sponsors' interests above those of its own country. Now it has forced a war that may leave Lebanon once again under Israeli occupation. Israel is already threatening to carve out a security zone in southern Lebanon. In fact, the war in Lebanon is a secondary arena for Israel, said Avi Ashkenazi in Mariv of Israel. The main prize is Iran, and since Israel is not a superpower on the scale of the United States, it can't fully devote itself to two fronts at once, but it may not have to. If Israel can weaken Hezbollah enough, the Shiite militia could well collapse as soon as the Ayatollahs are removed from power. Best columns of Europe. Greece. Reality bomb drops on UAE influencers. When the first Iranian drones crashed into the skyscrapers of Dubai, sirens started wailing. So did the obnoxious Greek influencers who have filled our social media feeds with images of beaches, glitzy nightclubs, and cars that cost as much as a small island, said Dimitris Efthimakis of Protagon. We are trapped, they cried in anguish, posting from pool decks overlooking the Persian Gulf. Help us leave. If they were aid workers or even normal workers trapped in a war zone and sounding the alarm, Greeks would have sympathy for our distressed compatriots. Instead, a domestic tsunami of mockery erupted. Who's living the good life now? We understand they're afraid of the bombs falling around them, but these people bombarded us mercilessly with images of excessive affluence. Club tables covered with champagne bottles, 40th floor swimming pools, that have filled us with a toxic blend of admiration, envy, and suspicion. Who pays for these trips? What did you do to wangle your mysterious invitation's super-rich host's lifestyle deals? Surely Greeks stuck back home, barely making ends meet, have the right to a bit of schadenfreude. In Dubai, we don't see a tourist in danger, but someone who until yesterday was gloating over his good fortune on Instagram and who has now been trapped by some divine judgment at the scene of his crime. DHS, exit Nome, enter Mullen. Christy Nome earned the distinction of being the first cabinet member to be fired by President Trump, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. It was well-deserved because Nome generated more scandal in her year as Department of Homeland Security Secretary than a normal presidency would muster in four. She oversaw ICE's brutal and deeply unpopular mass deportation campaign, falsely smeared two U.S. citizens shot dead by immigration agents as domestic terrorists, splashed taxpayer dollars on luxury jets while stalling FEMA disaster relief, and allegedly conducted an open affair with her special advisor, Corey Lewandowski. Both are married to other people and deny any romance. But ultimately, it wasn't Nome's supposed infidelity, incompetence, or self-enrichment that doomed her. It was pointing the finger at the boss. Asked in a Senate hearing if Trump had approved a $220 million DHS ad campaign, which starred Nome and benefited businesses close to her, she replied, "Every single bit." Trump quickly denied the claim and gave Nome the boot. It doesn't matter whether she was telling the truth. To implicate Trump is to violate his most sacred principle. Trump's nominee to replace Nome brings a lot of confrontational energy, said Jim Newell in Slate. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican of Oklahoma, is a former mixed martial arts fighter who seems eager to merge that fighting background with his politics. He challenged Teamsters boss Sean O'Brien to stand your butt up and fight during a 2023 Senate hearing and said last year that there'd be less fake news if people were allowed to use violence against journalists. Mullen isn't in any way qualified to be the leader of the nation's third largest cabinet department, said Garrett Graff in his newsletter. The owner of several plumbing and construction businesses, he has no experience in national security, immigration enforcement, or disaster response, DHS's key areas of responsibility. Maybe he'll turn out to be a better department head than Nome, but that's the lowest possible bar. There will be no reset under Mullen, said Anita Chabria in the Los Angeles Times. A MAGA loyalist, he's made it clear that he supports the most extreme immigration policies Trump world can offer. He's also an outspoken 2020 election denier and could potentially help Trump impose his will on the midterms by sending ICE agents to polling places. Nome was a train wreck we couldn't help but watch. By simply being low-key and less thirsty for press, Mullen may have far more success in advancing the goals of an administration that would prefer we stop looking. Iran. Did Israel persuade Trump to attack? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu finally found a president willing to buy into his Iran dream, said Alon Pinkas in the New Republic. Eliminating Iran's threat to Israel has been the be-all and end-all of Netanyahu's political identity, and he clearly helped talk President Trump into a joint all-out assault on Iran. The hawkish Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, also has boasted of playing a key role in helping Israel manipulate Trump into embracing a regime change war contrary to his America First foreign policy. Graham, who golfs with Trump and knows his psyche, reminded the president of Iran's 2024 attempt to assassinate him and urged him to take decisive action, saying that it would cement his legacy as a president even more consequential than Ronald Reagan. If you can collapse this terrorist regime, that's Berlin Wall stuff, he told Trump. Graham even traveled to Israel, met with its intelligence agency, and coached Netanyahu on what to say to get Trump on board. Don't blame Israel for Trump's decision, said Yair Rosenberg in The Atlantic. He's the most powerful person on earth, and the U.S. attack on Iran is the responsibility of the man who ordered it. Despite his isolationist rhetoric, Trump has shown an abiding belief in military coercion as a solution to American problems and has advocated attacking Iran and seizing its oil since 1980. Unfortunately, Secretary of State Marco Rubio fed into right-wing scapegoating of Israel by saying the U.S. knew Israel planned to attack and joined the bombing to defend its bases from Iranian retaliation. But Trump then denied that, insisting, "I might have forced Israel's hand." Still, Israeli officials are worried about how this ends, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. They reportedly are anxious about maintaining good relations with the U.S. as Americans in both political parties voice concerns about the costs of a prolonged war. Support for Israel among young Americans, especially progressives, has already eroded. The risk of anti-Semitic blowback is real, said Michael A. Cohen in MS.Now. Blaming Israel for manipulating Trump into attacking Iran plays into a millennia-old anti-Semitic trope about all-powerful Jews pulling the strings behind the scenes. Critics on both the left and right are already pointing fingers at Israel, with some portraying Netanyahu as Trump's puppet master. This is, as American Jews are prone to say, bad for the Jews. If the war drags on, casualties mount, and gas prices stay high, the need for a familiar scapegoat will grow. That could put a target on the backs of American Jews. Iran, America's troubling munitions math. The U.S. is currently dominating the skies over Iran, but the long-term math is not necessarily on America's side, said Farah Stockman in the New York Times. Since the war began, Iran has fired more than 1,000 ballistic missiles and launched more than 2,000 Shahed drones at U.S. bases, Israeli targets, and Arab allies. The easily concealed drones carry explosive payloads and cost as little as $20,000 to manufacture. In response, the U.S. and its allies rely on sophisticated yet costly defensive technologies, including the gold standard Patriot air defense system, which employs interceptors that take months to build and can cost more than $3 million per missile. In a short war, the U.S. has the clear advantage, but Iran can build hundreds of cheap, deadly drones much faster than the U.S. can build expensive interceptors, and the bill could become unsustainable over time. That time is fast approaching, said Ellen Mitchell in The Hill. America's munitions stockpiles will likely start to feel strain if the war stretches beyond the 4 to 5 week timeline laid out by Trump. Some critical weapons, including high-end interceptors, were partly depleted during the strike on Iran's nuclear facilities in 2025. President Trump insisted in a social media post that the U.S. has a virtually unlimited supply of weapons, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, but that's simply not true. That's why Lockheed Martin now aims to more than triple its production of Patriots to 2,000 a year by 2030. More ship-launched missiles are also badly needed. All of this comes at a big cost, and larger, faster deliveries will require Trump to lobby Congress for tens of billions in additional defense spending. Meanwhile, American allies are watching in disbelief, said Jack Detch in Politico. After pressuring European and Asian countries to spend big on American munitions, the Trump administration is now rerouting those weapons to U.S. bases in the Middle East, leaving allies angry and scared that arms the U.S. demanded they buy will never reach them. America's adversaries are watching, too, said Thomas Black in Bloomberg. Russia might see America's depleted inventories and cut off of deliveries of weapons to Europe as an opportunity to make further inroads in Ukraine. China may run the same calculations as its leaders mull invading Taiwan. The need for the U.S. to stockpile munitions and build its own drones is urgent, but for the next conflict, not this one. Why backyard birds are dying off? The ongoing decline in U.S. bird populations is accelerating faster every year, a large new study shows. The depressing finding confirms what ornithologists have long feared, reports the Washington Post. Researchers analyzed decades of data from the North American Breeding Bird Survey, in which thousands of scientists and amateur birders fan out each June along some 4,100 routes across the continent to count every bird they can find. They found that surveyors are now spotting roughly 300 fewer birds per route than they did in the late 1980s, a 15% drop. And it isn't obscure or already endangered birds bearing the brunt of the declines, it's familiar backyard species such as blackbirds and robins. Alarmingly, the biggest drops are being seen in regions with heavy pesticides and fertilizer use, which suggests a link to farming. That's a problem not just for biodiversity, but also for humans, since birds are often affected first by conditions that plague humans. The pesticide DDT, for example, was seen to harm bald eagle eggs and then later shown to disrupt human hormones. Amanda Rodewald of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, who wasn't involved in the study, says the findings should be a wake-up call about the dangers contaminants pose to all creatures. We live in the same environment as birds, and if they're not healthy for them, they're unlikely to be healthy for us. Marijuana's link to mental illness. People who used marijuana in their teenage years face double the risk of developing bipolar disorder or schizophrenia years later in adulthood. That's the sobering conclusion of a large new study based on the health data of 460,000 young people in Northern California who were followed from early adolescence until age 25. In addition to the much higher risk of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, teens who use cannabis also had a 33% higher risk of developing depression and a 25% higher risk of anxiety. The link was weaker among those who took up pot as older teens, which suggests that starting the drug younger is more damaging. The brain is still developing, study author Lynn Silver, a pediatrician at the Public Health Institute, tells NPR.org. The effects of cannabis on the receptors in the brain seem to have a significant impact on their neurological development. Silver says she hopes the findings will make kids think twice before they vape or pop a gummy. With legalization, we've had a tremendous wave of this perception of cannabis as a safe, natural product to treat your stress with, she says. That is simply not true. The book list, Everybody Loses by Danny Funt. It is impossible to watch sports now and not be reminded you can bet on them, said Alex Shepard in the Washington Post. Danny Funt's new book takes the reader inside every level of the seedy, corrupt, dispiriting world of sports gambling, creating a twisted travelogue that drives home just how much damage betting apps have done in the 8 years since they were legalized, not just by ruining gamblers' lives, but also by undermining the integrity of the games we love. Television, The Comeback. 21 years after Lisa Kudrow's cringe comedy debuted and 12 years after the launch of its second season, The Friends star is back for a third and final round as L.A. sitcom actress and reality show subject Valerie Cherish. As Valerie prepares to star in a new sitcom, changes are afoot in the writer's room where AI is now generating the jokes. Sunday, March 22nd at 10:30 p.m. HBO and HBO Max. The Faithful, Women of the Bible. Minnie Driver leads the cast of a three-part series with episodes airing weekly depicting the women of the Book of Genesis. Sunday, March 22nd at 8 p.m. Fox and Hulu. Obituaries. The counterculture icon who rallied Woodstock, Country Joe McDonald, 1942 to 2026. Through his darkly funny folk songs, Country Joe McDonald narrated the struggles of a generation radicalized by the Vietnam War. He was best known for his Vietnam War protest anthem, "I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die a Rag," 1965. But it was the cheer he led just before that at Woodstock that rallied the audience to the cause. He and his psychedelic folk rock group Country Joe and the Fish used to open shows with a chant of F-I-S-H and have the crowd shout along. By the time they got to Woodstock, they'd replaced that with a more vulgar four-letter word. "From the moment I yelled, 'Give us an F!'" It became a folk protest moment, McDonald said in 2002. There was a certain in-your-face Kurt Cobain-ness about it that matched the attitude of the time pretty well. Raised in El Monte, California by Communist Party members who named him for Joseph Stalin, Joseph Allen McDonald was born to be a leftist and an activist, said the Washington Post. After a stint in the Navy, he attended college in Los Angeles and planned to transfer to UC Berkeley, but ended up busking on the streets there instead. He became a major presence in the Bay Area music scene, dating Janis Joplin, putting out the arts and politics magazine Rag Baby, and writing psychedelic folk songs. His seminal, "I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag," was completed in less than an hour, said The Guardian. The deadpan talking track was a mock celebration of war and early senseless death from the jaded viewpoint of a draftee. "And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam." The song established him as a counterculture icon. McDonald never achieved the mainstream success of peers like the Grateful Dead or Jefferson Airplane, but he remained true to his musical instincts and lyrical themes, said the New York Times. One album explored feminism, another environmentalism, and his 1986 album Vietnam Experience looked back at the effects and legacy of the war. His final studio album, 2017's 50, celebrated his own half-century as a singer-songwriter and political rebel. "I think the Summer of Love thing was manufactured by the media or something, because I don't remember us thinking, 'Wow, this is the Summer of Love,'" he said in 2018. "I never felt a part of it, but I was really thrilled and happy to be a hippie." The Marine who got U.S. and Vietnamese evacuees out of Saigon. Juan José Valdez, 1937 to 2026. Juan José Valdez almost didn't make it out of Vietnam. The U.S. Marine had stayed behind as part of the unit evacuating the fleeing South Vietnamese who had helped the U.S. military, as well as the last remaining Americans from Saigon as North Vietnamese forces closed in. In the chaotic evacuation of April 1975, Valdez and his comrades worked all day and night loading people onto helicopters as pleading families clamored outside the locked embassy gates. After the ambassador boarded the last flight, the Marines retreated to the embassy rooftop to wait. When a chopper finally arrived, the others clambered aboard and Valdez followed, but he slipped going up the ramp as it was closing. He was holding by his fingertips when two guys I didn't know dragged me in, Valdez said in 1990. He was the last American soldier to leave the country. Born to a Mexican-American family in San Antonio, Juan José Valdez joined the Marines out of high school and served in combat in Vietnam from 1965 to 1967. Valdez returned for his second tour in 1974 and found the evacuation heartbreaking work, said the Times of the UK, as Vietnamese parents would try to put their children into his arms to be taken to America. For years, he battled survivor's guilt and ultimately felt the war had been pointless. Decorated for his bravery, Valdez retired in 1987 but remained intimately involved with the Corps, working as a civilian in California's Camp Pendleton, said the Washington Post. He said later that watching the botched U.S. exit from Afghanistan in 2021 brought up the same bitter feelings as Vietnam. We spent so much money, so many weapons, and so many infantry and army deaths, he said. And for what? That's all for this week's The Week. Tune in again next week. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.